Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
I just returned from a conference at Gordon College in Wenham, Massachusetts, where I had the good fortune of being one of the plenary speakers for the organization Christians in Political Science. It was a great opportunity, and I'm working to see if I can get the audio of my comments to post up here on our website as one of our podcasts. It'd almost be like I was interviewing myself. Besides that talk, though, one of the greater fortunes of being at the Christians in Political Science Conference was that I was able to participate officially in a panel regarding the role of Christians in secular universities and being an unofficial participant in another panel entitled Christians Studying Ourselves. And there I was more just of a loudmouth audience participant than a discussant or anything. Now, both of these panels were organized and very well run by Professor Kimberly Conger. The discussion generated in both of these panels was so good, in fact, that I thought it needed to get out to a wider audience. And so I invited Kimberly to come on our show soon after the conference, literally within 48 hours, so that none of the insights would be lost. As such, our topic today is about being Christian, or more generally, being religiously oriented, in an academic environment, one that is often very secular in its outlook. My guest, Kimberly Conger, is currently an instructor at Colorado State University, a lecturer at the University of Colorado, and was previously at Iowa State University. She received her PhD from the Ohio State University, not a Ohio State University or another Ohio State University, but the Ohio State University, in 2003, and also served as a Civitas Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. Kimberly is well regarded in political science circles, having recently published a book called The Christian Right and Republican State Politics, which we will link to on our website, as well as authoring numerous articles in journals such as Political Research Quarterly, Party Politics, Politics and Religion, and Perspectives on Politics. Kimberly, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I had to tease you a little bit on the Ohio State University, because being a big sports fan and watching athletes be asked what university they attended, they always tend to emphasize the or the when they talk about the Ohio State University. Do you happen to know why that is, being a Buckeye?
Actually, I do. And the other funny thing is that you'll notice that there's a difference in the way that academics list that affiliation on their CVs. Many of them intentionally put the Ohio State University as well. I don't know if it's like giving your shout out on Monday Night Football, but it's similar. Actually, the Ohio University, which is the sort of other state university in Ohio, actually sued Ohio State in the last 10 to 15 years for trademark infringement on the term Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, I don't know if it was officially because of that or technically because of that, but in some way there's a way to thumb their nose at Ohio University and say it has become the Ohio State University.
Well, that'll show them, and they can just say that they've been to more Rose Bowls than the other Ohio University.
Exactly,
I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right. So, hey, let's get into this issue of being a Christian or a religiously oriented person in academia. Again, we're going to possibly speculate about whether or not we're talking in reference specifically to Christians or to other different faith traditions here. Mm-hmm. I should note that you invited me initially to be on a panel that dealt with being Christian in a secular university, but that when the conference program came out, the title of the panel changed a little bit to Building the Kingdom in a Secular University. And that shook me a little bit, because I didn't know I was supposed to be one of these proactive carpenters building the kingdom, which I don't think I am. And that's actually an issue that I struggle with quite a bit. But that issue of how we as Christians behave in a secular university or in academia more generally is really a conversation worth having here. And I'm glad that we're going to have this. But to understand where you're coming from on this point, and to kind of fill in what your thoughts were on the panel on that, can we first get a little bit of background on you? Did you grow up in a religious household?
Yes, I did. Very strongly so. And many generations back. Mm-hmm. My family, someone actually asked me what my religious tradition was, I think, this past weekend. And I think I had to answer mutt, because my mother's side of the family is entirely conservative Anabaptist Mennonite. My dad's side of the family was conservative fundamental Baptist, and I went to an evangelical free church, another kind of evangelical church, growing up. So, yes, very much a religious household, but there's not one real tradition that I can point to say this is those are my people.
You basically covered a whole gamut of things. So, despite all those different mixes of backgrounds there, were you a regular churchgoer?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So there wasn't any part of the time in your life where you might say, well, I was a little bit dry in that area or not?
Probably not, except maybe for graduate school, when I think that's tough for everybody, regardless of their faith commitment, to be committed to anything but graduate school.
Yeah. No, we're going to talk about that in a second, but let's not get there quite yet. Let's actually talk a little bit about your K-12 education. Did you go through public schools, or were you involved in parochial, private, religious education?
Both, actually. Mm-hmm. We moved around a lot when I was much younger, so I mostly attended public school until through fifth grade. I think it was moving into junior high that sort of freaked my parents out, and that's when I moved into a Christian, non-denominational evangelical Christian school for sixth grade and through high school.
Yeah, moving into junior high freaks a lot of parents out.
Yeah.
As a parent right now of a student to a child who is going to go into junior high, I hear you on that one. I'm totally freaked out. Anyways, okay, so you it seems that the latter half of your education was spent more in private evangelical school. How about college? Where'd you go as an undergraduate?
I went to Wheaton College in Chicago,
okay,
which is definitely and unabashedly an evangelical institution. So.
Mm-hmm. And was that a conscious thought on your part? You came out of, you know, evangelical high school and you said, you know what, I'm going to be looking for religious college here. Or did you just do like I did? I said, I'm going to send out 20 applications and see what sticks.
You know, I sent out a bunch of applications, but there were a couple Christian colleges in that mix and a couple other places. But honestly, it was a visit to campus, and you know how that happens, I think, to a lot of students. They walk on campus at some university and say, this is it,
mm-hmm,
and that's pretty much what happened to me.
Oh, okay. That's good. That never happened to me, though. I have to admit, one of my desires was go to the University of Washington or University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, to become a forest ranger, which was my first, at least coming out of high school, was my first career objective. But I ended up going to Marquette University. They had a good basketball team there. And I didn't pick it for any particularly religious reason, which kind of becomes an interesting part of my story as well. We had to take theology classes. And I was like, okay, I guess that's part of the price of admission here. I could, as a student, get season tickets to a pretty good basketball program. And that, for me, was pretty important at that time in my life. So you're at Wheaton, and then you eventually chose to pursue an academic career. Why did you choose to go to The Ohio State University?
Well, there are some very good intellectual reasons that I can give you, and then a lot of practical things that just sort of happened all at once.
Well, let's start with the intellectual ones, because as intellectuals, we're supposed to always be promoting the intellectual ideas for why we do everything.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I knew that actually I went into graduate school to study international relations and had been given a suggestion to look at Ohio State by some of my undergrad professors, and also because some other people from my cohort at Wheaton who wanted to be political scientists had gone to Ohio State in American politics. And so really it was a good school with excellent faculty that I thought I could get into. And I had intended, of course, to apply to many graduate schools because, right, that's the that's what you're supposed to do.
Got to do that, yep.
But honestly, I had just gotten married, and my husband wasn't sure that he was ready for us to move and go pursue something else. And he decided that yes, he was, about 4 days before all of the application deadlines were, and I had to pick one school to get my application in for real. And I said, okay, Ohio State's probably my first choice, so we'll just try that one and see what happens. So I did absolutely the worst thing you can possibly do, which is send in one graduate application, and I got in. So that's
where
I went.
So you put everything on green on that roulette wheel.
I did.
Wow. Okay, that's good. I once again I applied to about 8 or so different institutions coming out of Marquette, and again, intellectual reasons for doing this. Yes, I only applied to the utmost important schools that match my intellectual interests, but right. I basically said, no, I got to live west of the Mississippi and they got to have a good basketball program. So I ended up at UCLA again for rather very non-intellectual reasons, but you know, it turned out okay. So, okay. So you put everything on green, or I should say Buckeye red, and that it came up, you're attending the university or the Ohio State University. Now coming from Wheaton, which is a small liberal arts college of great repute, what was your experience like going to a very large secular state school for graduate studies?
You know, honestly, it was not as strange as one might expect. I think part of it is that it didn't feel so massively huge because I was, as a graduate student, you're much more ensconced in your own department. You don't have a whole lot of contact with people outside the department.
Right.
And the department's big, but it wasn't a whole lot bigger than, it was about the size of one class at Wheaton. So, a couple hundred people. So that felt fine. In terms of the moving from a religious environment into a secular environment, I didn't really think about that a whole lot, mostly because I did not expect going in there to be much conversation about religious issues or about even the people around me's own individual faith. I mean, I've been pretty well trained to expect that I would, basically be with lots and lots of people who didn't have faith commitments when I got to graduate school. So that wasn't a huge shock. It was certainly a transition in terms of the way I thought about things. And I have to admit that at the beginning of seminar classes for probably the first 2 years, I would almost automatically bow my head expecting us to pray at the beginning of class.
Oh.
That's what we did at Wheaton almost all the time.
Oh, well, that's a giveaway.
I had to stop myself.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I did a lot of praying in graduate school, especially during the comprehensive exams.
Exactly.
Yeah,
though not communally, probably.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. There was a lot of, when it came to the comprehensive exams, which were pretty brutal at UCLA. I think there was a lot of that. You know, a lot of atheists all of a sudden saying, you know, just in case, better bow our heads and pray to get through this one. Now, did you continue to be a regular churchgoer throughout your graduate career? Or, I mean, you were married at the time,
right?
And so you have your husband there, and that's probably a good thing to help you kind of keep that balance between academia and regular life, including faith.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, on a personal level, I have to admit that we struggled to find a church home to be at when we were in Columbus. But besides that sort of challenge, yeah, we were fairly regular. I would say, when we talk about how religious behavior impacts voting, right? We distinguish between people who are in church every week and those people who are in church 2 or 3 times a month, right? So there's a difference there.
Uh-huh.
And we were probably in the 2 to 3 times a month category at that point.
Okay. So. All right. And while you were at Ohio State and amongst your graduate cohort, was there a fellowship that arose of Christians who were in graduate school, or was it a pretty isolated thing and nobody really talked about anything like that?
You know, the answer is sort of both. Ohio State is sort of notorious for not having any kind of strong graduate Christian organizations like exist in at other Research One universities.
Mm-hmm.
Groups like InterVarsity and the Navigators and that kind of stuff run really strong and well-developed graduate ministries, and there wasn't one at Ohio State. Now, interestingly, of course, there were several of us from Wheaton in the Ohio State Political Science program.
Oh, okay.
So to that extent, there was some conversation, and of course, we and our spouses and families hung out together, but there was not any kind of I'm not sure that maybe the rest of the of the graduate students all knew that we were similar and shared these kind of commitments, because mm-hmm. it just didn't come up a lot of the time.
I want to pause you for a second, just take a little sidestep. We mentioned there were a number of graduate students who had come from Wheaton that were at Ohio State, mm-hmm. because oftentimes there is this perception among Christians in secular state universities that, oh, we're persecuted, everybody hates us, and it's really difficult because we feel like we're being fed to the lions every day. But the fact that Ohio State University is picking students from Wheaton, mm-hmm. and everybody knows Wheaton's a religious school, mm-hmm. and if there's one place that if you really want to persecute Christians in academia, I mean, you pluck them out of the graduate admissions files right away, and that was not happening at Ohio State.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good observation to make there, and that you need to see that Wheaton tends to send a lot of students over to Ohio State. Now, you mentioned you went into graduate school to study international relations, but
yes.
your current research specialty is actually state politics,
yes.
with a big dose of the religious factor as a subject of study in there. Now, how did this transition occur? How did you get from international relations to studying state politics, religion, and politics?
You know, honestly, at the time that I was an undergraduate, one of the most influential scholars of religion and politics was one of my professors at Wheaton, Bud Kelstad. Now, he's since retired. Mm-hmm. And many people who wanted to go to graduate school were interested in American politics, and many in religion and politics because of Bud. And I just didn't want to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to strenuously avoid American politics and structured my undergraduate classes that way and things like that, and went to graduate school and did a year of international relations and really disliked it.
Mm.
It was just not what I had anticipated it would be. And so I spent the first summer after my first year in graduate school at the Summer Institute in Political Psychology, which was run for many years at Ohio State, and I now think has moved to, I think it rotates now, but it's run by the International Society for Political Psychology. And they did a good job of talking about both sort of elite psychology for international relations and math psychology for American politics, and it was the math psychology stuff, things like political socialization and how opinions are formed and those sorts of things, that was the most dramatically interesting to me. And I said, well, maybe I've just chosen the wrong field, right? Maybe I need to just to count it as a sunk cost, to buy our stuff and move and start over. And that's basically what I did.
Do you think there was anything about your religious background, something rattling around in your head, or your experience going to church all the time that led you to choose a path that's more oriented toward the study of religion and politics? Or was this purely an academic endeavor in a question?
No, it was definitely about where I came from. And I think that actually, I mean, in some ways, because I had avoided talking about American politics for so long, when I got to that conversation about how people think about politics, how they form their opinions, in the back of my head, I kept thinking, well, wouldn't it be interesting to figure out how all these people that I grew up with, who are sort of unusual on the far right end of the spectrum, generally speaking, when it comes to politics, how do they think about politics? To what degree is religion impacting that, or other things impacting that? So, for some academics, what they do is about their own biography, and I think in some ways that's really true for me, because that's who I was the most interested in when I thought about things like socialization and voting behavior and how public opinion is formed.
You know, that's a really interesting observation. I do want to come back to this later in the interview when we talk about the panel that you organized at the CPS conference called Christians Studying Ourselves, but I just have to take a side note here too and reveal a little bit of my biography, that when I was at UCLA, I was very interested in Latin American politics, and you know, I wanted to study constitutional design. It was during a period of time when there was a lot of democratization, rewriting of mm-hmm. the constitutional rules and stuff, and I never could really get my fingers on any particular dissertation topic that I really liked or that any of my advisors liked. And you know, there was a point in time I just walked away from graduate school for a little while and said, you know, I needed a break. I couldn't find anything fruitful to be studying. And I just happened to read a footnote in an article, I think it was by Al Steppen, it might have been, or I can't remember who it was now. I just know it's something, an interesting paradox in Latin America, that there were some very progressive churches, which we heard all about in the academic circles, and then there were some that remained very conservative. And I said, oh, this is a great, nice comparison and contrast type of dissertation, right? It's I tell my students, find a question that says, you know, why did something happen here and not there? Because it helps to organize you methodologically to say these things. And so I didn't have anything deep in my background personally that I thought, well, I need to study religion and politics. Although I don't know, maybe I did, having gone to Marquette University and taken a few theology classes. But I said, oh, this is kind of interesting. And so it was interesting that my path back to my own faith was actually led academically rather than my academic path being led through my religious path. So it comes a lot of different ways, shapes, and forms, and it's probably pretty difficult to stereotype any of us Christians in political science. So, but that gets us into the realm of being a Christian in political science or academia more generally. And I want to – you organized two panels. You actually were involved in a lot of panels at this conference. Intellectually, you're all over the place and putting your imprint on everybody, which was really kind of neat. But the two that I engaged most in was the first panel was called Building the Kingdom in a Secular University. And I should note that this was a panel, and as I mentioned, the conference was for a group called Christians in Political Science. And if you look down the list of conference participants, I think you could easily count on one hand and maybe a toe or two the number of scholars who were affiliated with a secular university. The vast majority of people attending this conference were from religiously based colleges, and most notably smaller religiously oriented colleges that still really held strong to their Christian mission. And this was one of those observations that came up right away in our panel called Building the Kingdom in a Secular University. Let me just toss that out to you. Why do you think there were so few participants from secular schools at the Christians in Political Science Conference?
You know, that's historically been a challenge for Christians in Political Science. You know, I know in other disciplines there's actually two different groups. There's a Christian group for those teaching at Christian colleges and a Christian group for those teaching at secular schools and research universities. So, I mean, I'm happy that we have not split in that way. But I think a lot of it is just the structures of value, let's say, at secular universities versus Christian colleges. You know, as someone who teaches at a secular university, any panel I organize, any paper that I give at CPS will not be on my CV. It's not something that is necessarily looked on or applauded, looked on well or applauded by your colleagues at secular schools. And so that's one part of it. I think the other part, too, is that particularly at research universities, and you know this as well as I do, we are, there are not unlimited travel funds, and we have to spend a lot of time at the big national political science conferences as part of what it means to build your career in a research university. And, you know, for people who teach at Christian colleges, it's not so much that they don't need those things, but that being at the Christians in Political Science Conference builds their career in ways that it just doesn't for people who teach at secular school.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And again, it's worth noting because I don't think we want to get into a persecution mindset here that says, no. Well, my colleagues think I went to a Christians in Political Science Conference and therefore I'm, you know, that's illegitimate or I'm engaging in voodoo or something along those lines. But, you know, rather it's a minor conference.
Right.
It's, you know, at the place I'm at, University of Washington, the conferences that are big and really count toward any kind of promotion are the American Political Science Association, the, you know, any of the regional conferences, the Midwest Political Science, the Western Political Science conferences, and occasionally, you know, the International Studies. And there's a few others that are considered big name conferences that draw hundreds, if not thousands of participants. And the Christians in Political Science Conference. I'm going to use this term. I'm going to call it a boutique conference, and yeah. I don't mean that in a negative way, but it's really a very specialized group of individuals that have a very specialized purpose in mind, and that just doesn't really hit the radar on a lot of the big academic screens and such.
Right. Exactly.
Actually, tell us a little bit of some people listening here might not know what the Christians in Political Science group is, and give us a little background on that.
Well, basically, the idea behind the group is to be a place where practicing believers of various stripes of Christianity, Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox, to be together and talk together and share together what it means to approach your work as a political scientist from a position of faith. How does it look through the eyes of faith? And so we tend to try to concentrate on both what does it mean to be a scholar of politics as a Christian, but also we want to serve as a network for Christians in political science so that they can have good connections that we can talk about career issues, but also scholarly issues and things like, you know, how do we balance all this work that we're asked to do with the other commitments that we have to our families and our religious communities and things like that. So as a sort of a comprehensive resource for Christians who are political scientists in all the various hats that we have to wear.
Yeah, that was one of the aspects that I really liked of this conference. Now, I know the Christians in Political Science meet every year at the big American Political Science Association. Mm-hmm. But this is one of these conferences, I think it's organized every other year or so. And it, you know, this was the first one that I ever attended. And it was kind of nice just, you know, sitting and doing fellowship.
Right.
And there were panels that dealt with academic topics. People were given papers on their research and different things like that. But the thing I most got out of it was just, you know, sitting around and talking to people is like, hey, you know, what's it like being in this university? This kind of challenge, do you face this? How do you deal with that? And that's what your panel was. And this is why I really I'm not somebody who loves to go to conference panels very much, but I really, really enjoyed both of the ones that you organized that I attended. So that was kind of neat. One thing, and just going back to the question I asked before, I noticed that there weren't that many participants from big secular universities. Again, you could count them on one hand generally, but I also noticed that there weren't that many people from the larger Christian universities, like say a Notre Dame or a Baylor. Do you have any mm-hmm. idea why that might have been?
I don't really have a good sense of that, to be perfectly honest. I know that currently CPS is, at least among its paying dues membership, is more highly evangelical than it ever has been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, in the past, there have been a much greater proportion of other kinds of Christians. So I suspect that may have something to do with it, particularly for the Catholic schools. But I don't really know, and maybe it's a case of not having done good marketing.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure.
Well, we could possibly do some of the marketing here now that, again, it might be being seen as just a evangelical small college
right.
conference type of thing. But, hey, you folks at Notre Dame or Baylor or other places, you know, y'all come on out next.
Yeah.
You know, that's I found it to be really great. And it was a much different change of pace. It was very much a change of pace as compared to some of the larger academic conferences. So I like it. Let me ask this question. This question is kind of the – you know, 500-pound gorilla sitting in the room that I'm sure some of our listeners are interested in, and, you know, why some people from these state secular institutions aren't coming out here. Do you think it might be because some of the Christians are scared to self-identify?
I do. I absolutely do. In some ways, it's a hard kind of balance to make a lot of times, I think, for Christians who teach at secular schools. One of the best comments that we had in that roundtable that we did on secular schools was the idea that it's not so much that there's overt discrimination against Christians in academia, but that as soon as someone finds out that you're a Christian, there's sort of an automatic assumption that you're maybe not as smart as everybody else.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself, of course, because the currency of academia is intellectualness and mm-hmm. intelligence. And so I think there's some fear based on that. But I suspect that that's actually less, that concern is less than the kind of career building stuff that we talked about before. I think that's a much bigger barrier to people being part of CPS than a fear factor is.
Yeah, I think you're right too. And when I came into the panel and we were discussing that, I thought, well, yeah, maybe there is that the fear factor of not wanting to identify. Because again, if somebody finds out you're going to evangelical church, they, you know, think that every Sunday you go out and you pick up a pair of snakes to handle and just in case, you know, you get bitten. And or a lot of you know, my secular colleagues see a lot of the passages of the Bible as being much like a fairy tale, and whereas I take it more as literal. And, you know, Jesus walking on water, and they saying, oh, that's just a parable for things. Like, oh, I don't know. That's kind of a miracle thing. That's important to me. And so they all of a sudden start questioning you on that belief, and then you're wondering if it does seep over into your other beliefs. And so people start looking at you. But I mean, again, I haven't met with any strong, aggressive, anti-Christian attitudes in the profession, especially in my department. My department is actually very good with it. I speak highly of my colleagues, and they hopefully speak highly of me in terms of this as well. So I know a lot of my evangelical friends ask me that because I live far away from the university. I'm outside of an academic ghetto where all the professors live. And so when somebody finds out that I'm a professor, that's one of the first questions that comes up. Oh, does everybody hate you at the university? I go, no, it's not really that. I don't think it is. And so, and again, I don't make a big deal about it. I am not handling snakes in the front of my classroom or, you know, walking throughout the halls, waving my hand saying sinners repent. But, you know, I do my work, which is what I do there. You know, I'm a professor. And I guess that kind of gets us to this next question of the panel and the different things that we talked about. Again, it's called Building the Kingdom in a Secular University. Let me ask you this. Why did you pick that name for the panel? Because at first when you contacted me, you said, hey, why don't you just talk about being a Christian in a university? And then all of a sudden it's building the kingdom. And I'm like, whoa, I didn't know I was supposed to be doing that. I'm not good at that. So,
well, you know, the real answer is that I was looking for a catchy title in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But I think too often we think about it in terms of surviving in the secular university,
yeah.
Right? And frankly, a lot of our conversation based around that in some ways because there were so many graduate students in the audience. And it's our job as faculty members to really help Christian graduate students, navigate the waters. That's true across the board. That's part of who we ought to be. But I really want us to think about it a step farther than that. To really think more comprehensively about what does it mean to be motivated by faith in a context where faith doesn't matter a whole lot, or maybe that asks us to do things or have a set of priorities that may not match up with everybody else at mm-hmm. the university. And so that was more what I was thinking of, was to try to get us to think more. For lack of a better term, more positively as opposed to negatively in terms of what is it that we do and how we think about what how our work fits into the conversation at a secular university.
Yeah, and it was a really, really good conversation. As you mentioned, there were a lot of graduate students there, so we felt that like we were giving them advice. But on the other hand, I was absorbing a lot of this stuff in here. And it's one of these challenges and tensions that I have because, you know, as a Christian, I know I'm supposed to be out there in the real world. In fact, you know, my pastor, we just recently had a whole series on this. He says, you know, you have to take your Christianity out into the world. And this includes the working world. You can't just compartmentalize your faith and say it only comes out on Sunday morning for an hour or two. He says, our church, we're all about basically taking our faith out there and trying to help folks in the real world. And we've made a very good, our church has made a very good progress in doing that. We have a series that helps people to apply Christianity, their Christian faith in different parts of the work world. But again, for me at a secular university, that's not an easy task given this whole church-state separation thing that we've seen arise in the court system over the past half century. And, you know, I'm always constantly thinking about, you know, what am I saying? If I say anything that even smacks lightly of proselytizing, I could get into some professional hot water or get called into the provost's office and fired or something. So, you know, some folks, they can be really sensitive about what you're saying to them, students especially, and this whole issue of, well, man, you're forcing me to adopt your religion is really key. So I struggle with that issue of how do I act as a Christian in the secular university. What's your feeling on this tension, or your beliefs or thoughts on this tension?
You know, I think the tension operates differently depending on which part of our roles as faculty we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of our research, in terms of the motivation behind our research, I think in a lot of ways we're not a whole lot different than some other kinds of minority groups in the academy. Women to a certain degree, people of color who basically in some ways have to justify what they're studying.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, I think we kind of operate on the same kind of playing field. In the classroom, I think it's a kind of a different story because I feel more concerned about what happens in the classroom, mostly because I am a state employee, and also because I don't want to make my students uncomfortable either. So the way I've come down on that a lot is it also just depends on the class. You know, I teach a religion and politics class, and it's pretty hard to teach that class without some sort of questions coming up about, you know, why do you know all these things about religion? Why are mm-hmm. you so interested in this?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And so, and I feel pretty free in that kind of setting to be like, look, I go to church every Sunday. This is part of who I am. And so that's why I understand these kinds of things. In other classes, I think it comes up less just by virtue of what's happening in class. And I think that, you know, the interesting thing is I think that Christian faculty, practicing Christians of all stripes, come to different conclusions about the best way to handle this.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll see really different approaches across universities and across individuals about where they feel comfortable in talking about their faith in class.
That's a good point. And I teach a religion and politics class too, and I don't overtly say here I'm going to church and explaining that, but it frequently comes out. I'm one of these people that, yeah, I have some prepared notes when I walk into the classroom, but you know, anything that pops into my head usually ends up coming out of my mouth pretty quickly. And you know, there are times when I'm illustrating a point and I'll say, oh, well, within my church, or oh, this past Sunday. And you know, then I think students can, you know, unless they're sleeping in the classroom, they figure it out pretty quickly. Oh, this guy's a regular churchgoer. And you know, oftentimes when that slips out, I go, oh, did I reveal too much? What should I be doing here? But on the other hand, you know, I've had hundreds of students, and nobody's complained about it yet. Nobody says I'm overtly forcing anybody to go to church or, you know, believe the things that I believe. And also what happens too is that I tend to be pretty critical of my own faith tradition. You know, I do a lot of historical teaching in that class on religion and politics. I said, you know, look at, here's where the Christians really messed up, and here's where we're still messing up today, and here's some of the problems that we have. And I think students, you know, at least recognize that I'm not, you know, unabashedly loving Christianity just, you know, for loving, you know, or I should say loving Christian institutions just because I belong to one.
I think that makes a huge difference. I think my perspective is that sometimes we give students too little credit for that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think as soon as they recognize that you are, you know, working really hard to give all sides of a story and are being honest about hard issues that come up. And I think this is true in other classes too, not just in religion and politics. I think that they're much more willing to give you leeway on that. They're not going to be offended. I think the other thing that I do a lot too is I say, if you've ever been in this kind of church, which sort of reminds them that they also might go to church,
mm-hmm.
That I think that helps a lot too.
Yeah, that does. And students are kind of good on it, but it's just often interesting. I've had a few lectures where I'd have students come up to me afterwards and said, oh man, you went really easy on the Catholic Church. You're just promoting them. But then a student, two people right behind in line, says, man, you were really dogging on the Catholic Church. Were you an anti-papist or something? I'm
right.
Like, yeah, that was the same lecture, you know? So yeah, that's a thing. Well, the classroom is one environment, but here's another one. And this came up too during our panel, and is another one that they talk about, that it's the realm of office hours. And students oftentimes come to meet with us one-on-one during office hours, they might have questions about the class, or they missed a lecture and they want something to be filled in, or they have other bureaucratic questions that might have to be resolved and stuff. But a lot of times they come in with academic problems that are oftentimes rooted in personal problems. And these come out whether we ask for them or not. And I actually don't. I just want to deal with the academic side of the question. Okay, so you're getting a D in this class. How can we get you up to a C or a B? But yeah, a lot of times students start telling us stuff about their personal lives. And, you know, for a Christian, we've been tasked, and my pastor will remind me this, we've been tasked with, you know, Christian charity, being able to speak to these people, speak to the downtrodden, the hurt, the suffering, and reach out to them. But in that environment, wow, you know, for me, it's really hard. What do I do? Now, there are procedures for this in our university. If a student comes to us and, you know, has a horrible personal problem, we are not supposed to be psychological counselors, and I am not qualified for that at all. So, you know, I immediately hand them a card saying, here's our student psychological services, and say, you know, I feel for you, but man, you got to resolve these other issues before I can help you with the academic stuff. And so I send them on their way to, you know, hopefully the psychological counseling center. But then when they leave, I'm saying, you know, this is an opportunity that I could have been a Christian here. And if I, you know, my pastor found out, I'm sure he'd be leaning over my shoulder saying, dude, you just missed a total opportunity to be a real good Christian. I how do you balance that? And what are your thoughts?
I've actually been thinking about this question a lot over the last couple of days since we were in that panel. So I suspect that serving the cause of Christ sometimes is not about telling them, well, here's a solution to some of your problems. I mean, I think in a lot of cases, and particularly for those really obvious bad news cases, when you walk them over to the counseling center, you are in fact being Christ to them. Mm-hmm. Because that's what they really need. There are things that have to, you know, that they need medical treatment, right? Those kinds of issues. In other cases, I think, I suspect the best way to help them, right? If that's our intention, then is to remind them of the kinds of support structures that they already have, many of which are faith related. Mm-hmm. You know, I may take a more not necessarily hands off, but a more non obviously Christian way of dealing with it than other people might. But for my money, I think in a lot of times, it's more effective to remind them that you're not the only person that they have to talk to.
Yeah.
Right. And I do ask a lot of questions like, have you talked to your parents? Right. You know, or mm-hmm. many of them don't think they can talk to their parents. Right. Have you talked to, you know, what do your friends say? And then I will usually say something like, do you go to church? Are there mm-hmm. people at, you know, are there people in your church or your religious body that you might be able to talk to who could really, give you some insight into where you are? So I tend to work on sort of that plane.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm always very nervous about those kind of conversations. I always keep my door wide open when I'm dealing with students.
Absolutely.
And, you know, very, cause I understand that we are in a pretty vulnerable profession, in that we are dealing with a lot of very young men and women, and, you know, very strenuous situations, type place. They've been away from home for the very first time. They're facing, you know, exams. They've always been A students, and now they're facing their first C or D. And I mean, it can get very stressful in that respect. And so I do tend to rely heavily upon our university counseling services. But you make a good point that there are a lot of other resources out there. And one of the things that I don't think a lot of my evangelical friends that probe me about what it's like to be a Christian at a secular university don't really understand is that most secular state universities are ringed by a number of churches and religious groups. You know, there's Absolutely. Always a Newman Center, a block off of campus somewhere.
Right.
And there's the Campus Crusade for Christ is always around. There's even fraternities and sororities that are devoted to religious ends or supporting religious goals. And that's one way to go about it. And it, again, it's not one of these issues that I can easily resolve in my head, and it's a constant struggle. So,
one of the big things too is that we don't, you know, in smaller institutions or in liberal arts colleges, you tend to have the same students over and over again in your classes.
Yeah.
And that changes the context in which those conversations happen. I think in big research universities like the ones you and I teach in, we're seeing these students one semester in their entire four-year period, and they may be in a class of 200, 300 people. So it's the context is just really different.
Yeah. No, that does it. You're right. They come through, you know, so fast, it seems. And I, as I was saying, most of my undergraduate classes are never smaller than 150 people. And so it's really difficult to know any students. And that actually might keep up, some of the barriers. For me, it's very important for me as a faculty member to understand or to get my students to understand what the barrier is, what the role is that I'm not a professional counselor. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm an instructor. That's my job. And I'm here to teach you about political economy or religion and politics or comparative politics. And, there are other places to go. And for me, I know that there are some professors, and this is especially true with younger professors, when they first come in, they feel like they have to be the friends of their students. And I found over time that that's not a role that I need to place myself in or that I want to place myself in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that's kind of interesting. How else might one build the kingdom in a secular university as a Christian? What else came from that panel that you found to be pretty insightful?
I think there were two other pieces to that. I think one of them was this idea that part of our responsibility being Christian faculty members is to our colleagues as well as to our students, and that remembering that our colleagues are, our people as well as intellectual people that we talk to, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a role for that in both being a listening ear and also being someone who is trustworthy. And there are a lot of politics in academic life, and
mm-hmm.
so being someone who is trustworthy in those kind of situations. I think the other thing too is that building a kingdom for Christian faculty also means being able to translate from academia back to the church, and there's a big role for us in helping other Christians think Christianly about politics.
Yeah.
And some of us do that really well. Some of us don't do that at all. But that in possibly sort of in general, that may be a way that we as Christian political scientists can help build the kingdom.
Yeah, that's really good. You make two points there. One, just dealing with our colleagues. And this is generally the way that I look at things. It's like, well, people pretty much know I'm a regular churchgoer, so I need to be a model of what a churchgoer should be. Basically, don't be a jerk, Tony. Right. And I try to do that as best as I can. There are times that I fail on that, and I'm just, oh man, I'm just, piling onto that stereotype of being a, jerky Christian. But, I try my best, and every morning I get up and, I pray that I can apply the golden rule for that day and hopefully can make it to bedtime by doing that. But, so that aspect. But again, you brought up something I hadn't really thought about, and this is very important, that is that we're also role models or people in the faith sector or the faith part of our lives look to as well to, this is what a professor looks like. And again, it's not, there's a lot of stereotypes about academia that evangelicals and other Christians hold that, aren't really true and need to be shaken from their mind a little bit. So, and I think that gets us to the other question that comes up, and this relates to the other panel that you organize, is Christians studying ourselves. And this definitely applies to you and me, because both you and I study religion and politics. We make that a core part of our research agenda. It's also part of our teaching agenda. For some other scholars, it might not be that big a deal. There are Christians who just study purely secular topics, the international relations and deterrence theory, or democratization in Vietnam or something like that. So it doesn't necessarily come to it. So tell us a little bit about that panel and some of the insights that you drew from the panel called Christians Studying Ourselves.
Yeah, we talked quite a bit about, and almost everybody, I think everybody in the room in some way or another studied their own faith groups. And that everything from just evangelicals in general, or I had hoped to have people in there too who studied themselves as Catholics or things like that. That didn't end up happening. But even down to more specific kinds of denominational groupings, mm-hmm. that's what you're studying. But I think there are two key issues that come up when we talk about Christians studying ourselves. But the first is about how we represent ourselves as social scientists to fellow believers. Mm-hmm. To say, you know, I'm a social scientist. I am a Christian, and I'm studying you as a Christian. And to what degree, what our responsibility is in that to our faith grouping, in terms of what do we emphasize? What do we de-emphasize? How do we talk about our faith group? Do we, if we're being unflattering, is that in some way detrimental to the religious cause that we have, right? So, mm-hmm. And the thing is, I think that this is true for people of faith across the board. This is an issue that I think we all have. So, and frankly, many people who study religion and politics in political science are people of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're Christians, we've a large grouping of Jews and Muslims also who study religion and politics, for practicing Jews and Muslims. So, that's part of it. I think the other piece of this too is in how we translate for academia what we understand about our groups that's not obvious to people who aren't believers.
Yeah.
So in translating things about how they talk about certain things that are talk about politics in spiritual terms that would not make sense to an outsider, but make sense to us because we understand what people mean when they use these kinds of spiritual terms.
Mm-hmm.
So those were kind of the biggest issues that we had, that we talked about.
And we go back to that, you know, the first part, the reflection about how we present our subjects, being part and parcel of that community. And this is an issue that always comes up with any kind of participant observation. Now, we might not be participant observers in the very narrow methodological sense where we're actually part of the community, but we're part of the broader faith community. And, you know, I might be studying Catholics, even though I'm not a Catholic, but I'm part of that big thing called Christianity.
Right.
And so that becomes an issue there. One of the things that struck me in our discussion during that panel was not only how we do that, but how do others perceive how we do that? Because there could be a very strong tendency for some of our secular colleagues to say, oh, you know, Tony goes to church and he's studying all those church people. Therefore, he's given a really, you know, polished shine to this thing called Christianity. He's ignoring some of this stuff. There must be some pressure that we feel regarding that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that most of us who are studying our own groups are pretty studious about making sure we're super objective, or, you know, going to the extreme of looking like we're critical of those groups,
yeah,
in order to make sure that nobody thinks that we're giving people a pass on certain kinds of political attitudes or stuff like that. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and that aspect of being perhaps overly critical of our groups too works in there too, because I've stopped at some point in time saying, yeah, well, maybe I shouldn't be. Am I going to be too overly critical and emphasize some stereotypes which really aren't true, but you know, when I'm finding there's a small group of people that do kind of behave this way, and if I mention that, one of my secular colleagues is going to go, aha, we all know that you are all snake handlers. We suspected that.
Right.
And, you know, that's pretty hard. I mean, for me, I do tend to be to take the tack that, well, maybe I should be a little bit more critical. Not so much that I'm worried that my colleagues will think I'm biased in one way, but, you know, it's another kind of tough love for the community, that if I find something in my research results that is impacting the Christian community negatively, I got to say, hey, guys, we're being jerks. We got to cut this out. Here's what the data is looking like. Here's how we look to the rest of the world. Should we really be looking that way? And so it's somewhat of a tough love kind of thing.
And I think that that's the key to it too. I mean, that's where I've basically come down, is that if I'm gonna be critical in print, right, in a scholarly outlet, I need to be willing to say those things inside the community as well. I need to be able to say that to the church. If I'm not willing to make that criticism in the church, then I need to think really hard about what I'm doing if I'm doing it in a secular publication.
Yeah.
Not to say that somehow I wouldn't, it goes the way of saying, not that I wouldn't print something, not that I wouldn't try to publish something in a secular publication, but that I need to be willing to talk back to my own community and things if it holds them up to looking bad in public.
Yeah. And that brings us to this dealing with our own community, and that we oftentimes go to do research. It might be one-on-one interviews. I know we had Corwin Smith, who's been on this podcast before, and he was talking about doing survey research where you're, as a researcher, you're much more anonymous to,
right,
to somebody. But, you know, some of these more one-on-one interviews, talking to either elites, the pastors or people who are movers and shakers within the Christian community, or just, you know, run-of-the-mill Christians in a congregation or some religious NGO, we go and we talk with them, and we have to wrestle with this question of, well, to what extent do we reveal who we are?
Right.
I mean, there's one side of the equation says, okay, we need to be objective observers, and so I just come in with a blank face, almost like a robot or a machine, that I just want to record what I see there. But then, you know, there is some skepticism, as we noted, within the Christian community or even religious communities in general. It could be, you know, Jews and Muslims, could be a lot of different groups who look at academics and they wonder, you know, what are your motives here? I want to know a little bit more about you. And so the flip side of that coin then is say, well, if I do reveal a little bit more about me, does that change what we understand? It's, you know, we become part of the process. If I say, yeah, I'm a regular churchgoer at Duval Church, well, one, that opens up a whole set of doors. People say, okay, I welcome you because you're one of us, I understand. But then people might start talking to us in ways that also alters their behavior. So, man, that's a hard balance too.
It really is. I really hope you can't hear that. That's the building.
That's your building?
That's my building. Yes.
Is the building falling down right now?
It might be.
Okay.
I think it's the air conditioner compressor.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. My dog has appeared on the podcast several times before barking, and if people can listen to some of the earlier podcasts, they can maybe find that. But so anyway, get back to the question.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I find that troubling. I find that the most troubling in the sense that I don't want to give the impression to those people, because I share their faith, that I am somehow going to be obligated to talk about everything that they do in a positive light.
Yes, very good point.
You know, I'm less concerned about some of the standard social science research method kind of issues about, you know, am I not seeing the real picture of things because they think I'm one of the community, you know, this kind of participant observer issues. But I'm more concerned about them coming back to me later and saying, hey, we trusted you because you're one of us, and then you did this.
Yeah.
So I actually haven't had that happen. I think I have the potential in some of my work, but I've never actually had that happen. But it continues to be a fear of mine.
Yeah, no, that is one of these things that we struggle with. And what was nice about the panel that we were on is that, you know, people shared a lot of their thinking on this and how they manage it. And I think, you know, what it comes down to, and I was very optimistic about what I heard, or very optimistic's not the right word, but very relieved about what I heard, is that we have a lot of very serious scholars who are Christians who go in there and they say, hey, you know, everything in these Christian institutions isn't perfect, and we have to reveal some of the imperfections, some of the blemishes, some of the knuckleheaded behavior that we see. And when we go into those participant observation situations, we're really above board on this, to say, hey, you know, I'm part of this community. Some people had said, well, you know, I'm only going to share that if they ask me about it, and then I'll do it. Some people are a little bit more forthright because it does help to open a few doors and get to talk to some people who might not otherwise talk about it. But, you know, again, I was very heartened. I think that's the term I'm looking for. Very heartened to see that, you know, we're in a group of scholars that said, listen, you know, if there's, you know, something that I don't like and that reflects negatively on the Christian community, you know, I got to report this, because that's part of my job as a scholar, to call things as they are. And, you know, by the way, that might just help those people. They might feel betrayed by me and say, oh, you're a Christian scholar and you're you're telling us that, you know, we're having negative consequences on doing this, that, or the other thing. But on the other hand, is that, hey, maybe you need to know that. Maybe you need to, the Christian community has to reflect upon that and change things a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's part of our dual role, maybe, is the way to think about it, in terms of being Christian academics, to say that we have to take seriously both words in that description, right? We are academics and we are also Christians, and so we're part of both of those communities and engaging in both of those communities.
Yeah. Well, those are good thoughts to kind of leave off on, is that we walk in many different communities and we wear a lot of different hats, although I only tend to wear cowboy hats, but it's one of those interesting things that I'm glad that a group like Christians in Political Science exists for us to get together and talk about. And again, I'm glad for your efforts, your work on this front to really get the conversation going, because I benefited from it immensely.
That's great. It was great to have you as part of those conversations.
And again, I want to thank you, Kimberly, for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.